I am not an elephant! I am not an animal! I am a human being!
Step right up and see the Freaky Cut Print Film Podcast episode number 53. Here are your hosts, Jeff, Dave, and Chris.
Hello, Mr. and Mrs. Internet. It's me, Jeff Rollins, and you're listening to the Cut Print Film Podcast, episode 53. Who's with me today?
I'm one of your hosts, Lights David Costell, and I'm here with Camera Chris Evangelista and Action Jeff Rollins.
I already introduced myself, Dave.
Yes, let me speak for myself. My name is not Camera Chris Evangelista.
I thought I'd try that out tonight.
Well, we're a film podcast, and we talk about movies.
Well, see, that's built into my whole persona
right.
that I gave us.
I wish you could build it out of it with a hammer.
And we're rolling.
Yeah.
That's like what you say after.
Listen, I understand what you're doing. Yeah. I don't like it one bit.
It's just not working.
All right. Well, then when that's happening, you say, cut.
All right.
All right.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks for all of that.
Speaking of cut, put your head in this guillotine.
All right. So today we're going to be talking about David Lynch's The Elephant Man, and we're going to be talking about the indie horror film It Follows.
Right.
But first, Chris saw a very important film this week.
That's right. This is the much-buzzed Adam Sandler film, The Cobbler. And this film, what was it? It was, what was the film festival this showed up at, Dave? Do you remember? Was it TIFF? Was it one?
Yeah, Sundance? One of those. Yeah, it was TIFF.
Yeah, so it showed up at TIFF.
Toronto yes. International Film Festival.
Toronto International Film Festival, and it stunned everyone because of how bad it was. And so basically just the badness alone sort of hyped it up for us, especially me. I love bad movies. I'm a weirdo. And just
it's the Schadenfreude.
Yeah, just something about bad movies intrigues me, especially movies that are so bad they're kind of amazing. And boy, does The Cobbler fit into that genre. It's The Cobbler is a very strange film. Adam Sandler plays a cobbler. He's living in New York.
Well, this is a 2015. Could you explain to me what a cobbler is?
A cobbler is someone who fixes shoes. And,
see, when my shoes fall apart, I throw them in the garbage and
yes.
buy a new pair.
I just go right onto Zappos and I get a new pair. But
what like made Adam Sandler read this script and go like, I gotta do this movie?
Well, the guy who directed it, I think his name is Thomas McCarthy. And he directed a film called The Station Agent, which is actually very good. Peter Dinklage is in it. He directed Win-Win, that Paul Giamatti wrestling movie, which is also really good. And those
what
are two movies.
What happened?
Well, yeah, they're both quirky, sort of offbeat movies, but they work. And it seems like he's going for that with this, and boy, does it not work. So Adam Sandler's character, he's a cobbler. That's the other thing. They keep calling him a cobbler, and they're never like, you're a shoe repairer. It's always, you're a cobbler. So it's been handed down from generations to generations. His father, played by Dustin Hoffman, is missing. He left the family.
Like Howard Hughes?
Sort of.
More like Howard Shoes.
Oh, okay.
Thank you, everyone.
Thanks.
We should just go home now.
Yeah, I don't know if we're going to top that. So Adam Sandler, he's like this sad sack guy. He hates his life. But then he discovers in the basement he has a magic shoe repair machine that was given to his ancestors by an angel. And I'm not making this up. This is all in the film. So
if I discovered a magic shoe repair machine, I'd be like, well, that's useless.
Yeah, I'd put it out in the curb.
This is time for a yard sale, honey.
To eBay this goes. So, but this machine, any shoe that gets repaired on it, if you put the shoes on, you then are able to look and sound like the person who owns the shoes.
Well, if the shoe fits, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, it's you know, you're walking a mile in someone else's shoes, which they say at least 10 times.
Sounds uncomfortable.
So, and that alone, it sounds like it's one of those goofy Adam Sandler like movies like Click, where
yeah.
he gets the remote.
It sounds exactly like Click.
But it's not. This is a really weird, depressing sort of – it's not supposed to be funny. It's not a comedy.
Oh, it's not funny.
It's it's not played for laughs. It's played sort of as this like offbeat indie drama, which is – it's just bizarre. It's just a weird movie because he puts on the shoes, he becomes different people, and it's all like different ethnicities. He puts on shoes, he becomes like a Chinese person, and he goes to Chinatown, and then he puts on Method Man is in the film. He puts on Method Man shoes, and he robs someone else because the guy is scared of this big black guy he's pretending to be.
Accidentally robs somebody?
No, on purpose. He's a dick. He puts on the shoes and steals.
Wait, so he takes on the characteristics?
No, it's himself. But
What the fuck are we talking about? I don't know.
It's weird. And at one point, he literally stabs someone to death with a pair of shoes.
Oh, this is too much.
It's a very weird film. I don't know what to make of it. I really don't.
You gave it a 4 out of 10.
I dropped that down.
Oh, you did?
No, it's still at a 4 because...
It was the best review on the internet for that movie.
It's a terrible movie, but...
I think you might have been so shell-shocked by...
It's more that, like, I gave it a 4 because as terrible as it is, you sort of need to see it just to be blown away at how weird...
It sounded ambitious, which I... Yeah, you kind of have to give a film credit for that.
Yeah, it's trying, and man, does it not work. And
it's pulling itself up by its bootstraps.
And that's a good one, Dave. Time to go home, everyone.
And this is a spoiler, but I got to give away the ending.
All right, so stop listening now if you're hell-bent on watching The Cobbler.
Does it involve shoe polish?
No. Oh. So the whole movie, this whole thing about how Adam Sandler's dad, is played by Dustin Hoffman, is missing and all this stuff. And also the whole film... Next door is a barber played by Steve Buscemi.
Is it a magic barber?
No. Well, actually it is, because it's revealed that it's not actually Steve Buscemi, it's Dustin Hoffman, who's been in disguise the whole movie. And at the end, he takes off his shoes and he's like, son, I've been here the whole time and I want to show you something. And he takes him to this secret basement where he has this Rolls Royce that has a license plate that says Cobbler on the license plate. And Dustin Hoffman reveals that, like, there's this whole network of superhero cobblers who help people.
So it's like Kingsman Secret Service.
It's sort of like it's like they're trying to make this like the Avengers, where it's like not just cobblers, but like dry cleaners have their own sort of thing. Where
you're not going to believe this. I don't care about this one bit.
No. I don't believe
this. This sounds terrible.
It's insane. I've never seen a movie like this. And they just, see The Cobbler, everyone. So
they're launching a universe, The Cobbler Corps?
Yeah, it's like they're trying to build a cinematic universe.
Cobble Corps.
From The Cobblers.
Yes, it's The Cobble Corps.
So, yeah. Don't go out of your way to see The Cobbler, but if this ever ends up on Netflix...
Unless your shoes are broken.
Stop right there.
Then go and see him.
Yes, if the sole of your shoe is broken, go see your local cobbler. You're going to have to travel about 200 miles into the nearest...
the nearest time machine.
If you have a hipster area of your nearest city, you're going to have to find it out, because there's no cobblers anywhere in the suburbs.
Yeah. So, if the shoe fits, see The Cobbler. Thanks, everyone.
Good night, folks.
Anyway, let's move on to a better film than The Cobbler, shall we?
Recently, there's been a lot of praise for the film.
Me, Dave Costa.
Yes, Dave, you're doing great
but
work.
That just went right out the window right now.
For the indie horror film It Follows, directed by David Robert Mitchell, it came out... it's actually been released slowly over the festival circuit.
Yeah, I saw this back in the Philly Film Festival, which was, what was that, June?
October.
October, yeah. Man, I was way off.
So it's been a staggered release, but it finally released wide this past week, and so now we can all talk about it.
And boy, is everyone talking about it.
They are. Everybody's calling it the scariest movie they ever saw, which, you know, we'll talk about that. But
I saw this before, like pre-hype. And I liked it, but I was sort of, and we're going to talk about this, but the last, I'd say, 45 minutes of the film totally lost me. But, man, everyone else seems to love this movie, so yeah. I don't...
Well, if any hardcore Cut Print Film podcast listeners know that I'm a baby when it comes to spooky movies.
Baby's a scaredy cat.
Dave doesn't like ghouly movies.
Yes.
Loves girly movies, though.
So this thing being hyped up as the scariest movie since the Blair Witch Project had me going, no, I'll never see that.
Dave still hasn't watched The Babadook just because he's terrified. No,
the trailer gave me nightmares, and that's not a lie.
All right, so this film is about Well, it stars Maika. Is it Maika or Maika?
I always say Maika.
Let's say Maika. Maika Monroe.
Right, who was in The Guest.
Yeah, she...
And she was great in that, and she's really good in this.
And you know where else she's really good? Our interview with Maika Monroe on cutprintfilm.com.
That's right.
You can read.
Sweet.
Okay, so it stars Maika Monroe as this teenager.
Oh, wait. Do we want to spoil this movie? Because not a lot of people have seen it.
I don't...
If we're going to get into spoilers, we'll warn you.
Okay. She plays this teenager who has sex with a boy that she likes.
Right.
And
he's an older boy.
Yes, in his early 20s. And he reveals to her that he has passed on this sexually transmitted ghost.
Yeah, that's pretty much what it is, the sexually transmitted ghost.
And what this ghost does is it follows you, yeah, as the title suggests, very slowly, but it's very smart and it's persistent and it will never stop following you until it touches you and kills you.
Right, and they say, you know, it doesn't think, it doesn't feel, it just follows you.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the Terminator.
I really like that premise that it follows you from the last location you saw it.
Yeah.
Like, so if you drive far away, it's the whole time it's walking in a direct line towards you, trying to get to you.
There's a lot of stuff in this movie I love.
Which, yes, I feel like wasn't used enough.
It could have been, yeah, I agree.
It could have been used with more, like some flight scenarios and some,
because
you know what I mean?
It's
like
such an effective idea,
yeah,
that,
yeah,
works every time they use it. It works every single time.
Oh my God.
When you see something following in the distance. And there's a lot of homages to Halloween,
yes,
where you see Michael Myers in the backgrounds of shots.
Yeah. And sometimes the ghost is wearing like the Michael Myers mask.
Never.
So that's
not
like,
once.
It's not every scene, but there's a majority of the scenes in this film where there's almost always something in the background. Even the scenes where they don't, like, where quote unquote something scary doesn't happen.
Yeah.
There's always something, yeah, further away. And I love the way this is directed is fucking fantastic.
There's David Robert Mitchell directed it, and I really can't wait to see what else this guy does.
Yeah, while I don't think this is one of the best horror movies ever, this is one of the best directed horror movies I've ever seen.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
There's some awesome moments where you as an audience member, you'll see something in the background and you're like, wait, is that it?
Yeah.
And
yeah,
like, so that keeps happening throughout the whole
movie.
And
he does a great thing with that. There's a moment of comic relief where they're all sitting around and the one character is like, oh, do you see that girl? And everyone else is like, yes. And I loved that. I thought that was a nice...
And the girl like looks at him,
yeah,
all weird. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is... Like you said, Chris, the first 45 minutes are very, very good.
Oh,
and it's unlike any horror film I've ever seen, really.
Yeah.
I think this idea is so the take on this idea of something following you and pursuing you and chasing you, the way it's tackled in this film is so fresh and new and well directed,
yeah,
that it scared the hell out of me every single time they used it.
Oh, yeah.
But the film, I don't want to use your term of going off the rails, because I don't think it goes off the rails.
I think it does.
But there's a fork in the road, and it takes the fork that I might not have taken.
All right, well, let's just say right now, spoilers, and let's just talk,
yes,
about this.
This is the point where we're going to spoil It Follows.
Yeah, so if you haven't seen it yet, you know, fast forward, whatever.
I kind of disagree with you guys, which is
weird. All right, well, let me say my point for where the film starts to lose me. Everything up until the point where they go to, it's like a beach house. It's like the guy across the street, it's like his family's beach house.
Yeah.
Everything up into, even including that, works for me.
Yeah.
And then as soon as, basically, the character, her name is Jay, she gets in a car and she drives away, and then she gets into an accident, and she ends up in the hospital. Everything from that on...
It's weird.
...fucking loses me. And it redeems itself, because the last shot of this film... I fucking love
it. Okay. See, I was going to say
gives
that.
Me the chills. It's creepy. I love that.
Yeah, it ends on a great note.
It's a,
yeah,
perfect ending,
yeah,
for this.
Yeah,
but it is.
Everything up until that point, from her in the hospital to that ending, I don't like. There's this lengthy, almost endless sequence where, I don't know why, but the kids, their idea to kill the ghost, I guess, is to electrocute it in this big abandoned pool in this big mansion. I don't know what.
I don't know why that was the logical solution,
yeah,
to the problem.
I loved that part. Like, I really liked the pool sequence.
It's well filmed. It doesn't fit,
yeah,
with the movie. It doesn't fit with the tone.
I love that it, like...
It turns into, like, Gremlins, like all this goofy shit's
maybe
going
on. That's why I like it. Because I love Gremlins, but I also like that it doesn't work. Like, because the whole time they're setting it up, like the pool,
yeah,
electrocution, you're like, that wouldn't work. Like, it would, you would trip the breakers the second you dropped like a fucking bug zapper into a pool. And that's exactly what happened in the movie.
I think why I don't like it, because it's stupid and the movie is so smart up until this point. And even the kids themselves, they're not dumb kids. But then this idea where it's just like, we can electrocute the ghost? Who the fuck thinks like that? Yeah. That's so ridiculous.
And that's exactly what I didn't like, because, like I said, I don't understand how that was the logical solution and everybody goes along with it like, oh, yes, this makes a lot of sense.
Well, it's almost like they cut a scene. Like, there's a scene before where, like, they explain where they get this idea.
That's exactly how
I think
felt.
The point is that, like, all logical approaches that they've tried haven't worked. So it kind of makes sense that they're thinking outside the box. They're trying to do something different,
I guess.
And
but
it's like, how do you kill a ghost? Okay, let's try electrocuting
it. I don't know. Just of all the ideas that they jump to, that is just weird to me.
But what I do like about this film, and it can be said about a lot of recent like indie low budget horror, is that this movie does so much with such a little budget. It's all acting. There's almost no special effects aside from
It's one. Acting and the camera work is fucking amazing.
It's all acting and directing. That's where all the money was spent. I think
another reason why I don't like the pool thing is because that's the one sequence in the film where they start throwing special effects at you, and it's like you see like the ghosts outlined in water and stuff like that. And it's like Hollow Man. Like I don't need this. Like,
yeah, it worked so well up until that point where it was just somebody with some fake blood on them.
And even just not like the second time you see the It Following thing where the character Jay, she's at school.
Yeah.
And you see through a back window all across this old woman. And it's just an old woman. There's nothing outwardly scary about her, but you just see her getting closer and closer. And that's terrifying the way it's filmed. And that's so much more effective than water outline ghost. Like, yeah, I don't need that.
I totally agree.
I will say this. I didn't find this movie scary at all.
Really?
See, that's for somebody who's...
To me, that's insane.
Yeah, because I'm dead inside when it comes to horror, because I've seen much of it. Exactly. But this, it creeped me out.
I'm terrified of horror movies, but this isn't something that, like, will stick with me. It had no, like, lasting... the movie's great. As a movie, like, just like The Guest, which is not a scary movie,
right,
and has, like...
That's more of a
vibes
thriller.
Of horror.
Yeah,
you know?
It's a horror theme.
That's what this felt like to me, even though it's more overtly a horror film. It just didn't feel like it was trying to be scary. You know what I mean?
Yeah, really?
Maybe that's what it is that it's not trying to... Like, it's not doing...
I think it's trying to be scary.
I think it is scary. Yeah. I think this is a very scary
movie.
I'm
disturbing.
I'm
like,
very surprised that it didn't creep you out.
Like, in the way Enemy is disturbing, that's how this is. It's not, like, overtly like, this is scary.
Well, there's no jump scares in it.
Right, which
is
not horror to begin with.
I mean, there's...
If you're,
it's not startling. I mean,
I equate this scary wise to something like The Shining
or Halloween.
I'm not saying it's as good as The Shining. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying that's the type of horror that this is.
It's psychological.
But those movies give me nightmares, and I don't feel like this is.
I don't know. I can see how this could give somebody nightmares. Yeah. Not me. It didn't give me nightmares.
Like I said,
the hell out of me.
Like, I saw this back in October, and even though I don't love it as much as everyone else, it still has stuck with me. Like, at least once in the last, every month since October, I've thought about something from this movie.
And I think that's part of why everybody's saying, oh, this is the scariest movie in a long time, because it does stick with you. It makes you think about things. It's doing a lot more than just, boo,
right,
I'm a ghost man.
Yeah. There's a lot of, just talking about the direction some more, I loved, anytime there's an adult in the film, other than the It Follows characters, they're always sort of blurry and out of frame. Mm-hmm. I really love that, because it perfectly cut the characters off to show that, like, they're on their own.
Right.
Like, Jay's mom, she's in a lot of scenes, but you never see, like, her face, which I loved. I loved
it. It's a very adolescent movie.
Yeah.
Well, one of our writers wrote a piece about It Follows. Josh Oakley was the writer, and he equated the story of It Follows... The ghost, he equated that to the looming presence of adulthood.
Which is a neat observation.
It's a great observation. Yeah. And I put some stock into that heavily, because, like you said, all the adults in this film are on the margins. They're blurred. And the idea of sex being what transmits this haunting from person to person, sex is used as a sort of like... an allusion to adulthood and the responsibility that comes with being adult and having sex, and and it follows you. It truly does follow you. I mean, I think that's a good observation, and I think this movie is doing a whole lot more than just boo.
Yeah.
Don't have sex.
Yeah, that's interesting, because like one of the major symbols of that transition is like a threshold in a door, and there's so many times in this movie where the creature's trying to come through a door and it can't, so there's like that tension there between adulthood and childhood. That is an awesome observation. I took it more as death, but now thinking about it that way, like the suburban themes make more sense.
I mean, death is just the ultimate, that's the end game.
Unless you're a vampire,
you're
like
fully
me.
Grown up when you're dead.
Yes.
One thing that sort of bothered me, which I haven't seen anyone really talk about, so maybe I'm just nuts, but I feel like there was a little, the term is slut-shaming going on in this. Did anyone else pick up on that? Because it's sort of like the message is sort of like, oh, she finally has sex and now her life is ruined. And like, there's sort of like it's sort of like that old-timey sensibility where, you know, like, don't sleep around, don't, you know.
I didn't get that.
There's even actually a line where he's like, they all go to see the boy who gave her the disease, and they're all sitting around, and he's like, you know, just have sex with anyone, it's easier for girls. And like, that sort of line right there sort of just, it bothered me.
But that type of line, I can agree with you on the whole slut shaming, you know, idea.
I attribute that line to that character, though. Yeah, I don't attribute it to the film.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I don't think the film's condemning sex at all.
No, not at all.
I think it's because sex is an inevitability. Oh, I really got that one out. Hang on, let me untie my tongue.
Stop eating that Laffy Taffy over there.
Sex seems like such a normal part of all these kids' lives at this point. Like, it isn't like, oh, did you have sex?
Exactly. And that's why I don't think the film's condemning it at all. And I think the haunting is just, you know, like I said, I think it's a factor of life that's just, it's coming for you no matter what. No matter what you do, it is coming and it follows you.
The thing I love most about this movie is it's another entry into this new genre of like nostalgia horror, which is like, fucking awesome.
It fits in with that, that horror movies lately owe a great debt to John Carpenter. Like, I feel like they should be just sending him royalty checks.
Well, he needs the money. Have you seen his latest films?
He needs to buy more cigarettes. Because this, The Guest, Cold in July is another movie. They might as well just be like,
I would even say Blue Ruin.
Even that, I would agree with that. They need like sort of like inspired by John Carpenter tags in them. It's just that, and it's great because I love John Carpenter. And it's kind of nice that like he's getting this sort of weird retro respect in a way.
Yeah. John Carpenter directed Halloween. I recommended that on a podcast. I don't know if you guys have ever seen that movie.
No, not once. Also, with just horror in general, there's been a lot of vintage type films lately in the last 5 years or so. Ty West, his House of the Devil.
Yeah,
film,
that's true.
That takes place in the 80s, but
because all the kids like us are growing up, and now they're in positions where they're making movies and.
Right.
At the same time, like, I don't know what that says about us.
Maybe we should make a movie.
No, not us in this room. I mean, us as a society now, where like to have really good horror, we have to go back in time. Apparently, there's no like modern. I can't think of a, because even though this film I would say is set in modern times, it has that sort of 80s feel to it. Like, I can't remember the last time I saw a modern horror film that was effective. I mean,
I think that sensibility is programmed in us because we grew up in the era of remakes and everything being rehashed, so we're, you know, that's like part of us now is rebranding what we know instead of being ultra creative.
However, I will say the Babadook is an entirely original idea that takes place
in
present day.
But it's also
technology has no bearing on that film.
I love Paranormal Activity, and I think that's
is a good example.
That's also another low budget indie horror film. Yeah. I mean,
and Halloween. I don't know if you guys have ever seen.
Yeah, Dave, we're all familiar with
it's
the work.
It's very modern.
John Carpenter's Halloween.
Dave met the Rob Zombie one.
Oh, a masterpiece. But yeah, I think a lot of indie horror lately, especially, is the better horror film to
absolutely.
See. All these major, big-budget horror films are abysmal. In fact, the studios have completely abandoned them.
I would love a big-budget horror movie that works again, because, well, man,
the best you're going to get is Platinum Dunes putting out remakes of, again, with the remakes, Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah,
Annabelle.
That movie was absolutely terrible.
I actually liked the Texas Chainsaw remake, the Platinum Dunes one. I thought that was well made. The Nightmare on Elm Street one was garbage.
That was an utter pile of dog shit.
Yeah. But yeah, you think about The Shining. That was actually a big budget horror movie. Like, they don't do that anymore. No. Well, I think the last thing I could think of would be like Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula is like the last big lavish Hollywood horror movie. Yeah. It's like all I can think of.
The Ring.
The good thing is that Chris Winger, that's his name, right? The guy who directed The Guest.
Adam Winger.
And then this guy, David Robert Mitchell. These movies are getting them a lot of attention. So
I think it's excellent.
Luckily, hopefully, I mean, they're going to get more money and
be
able to
make like real indie horror sensibility can get enormous budgets behind them. Hopefully, I'm saying this all theoretically.
And Ty West has a pretty big following now too.
Yes, he does.
I'm hoping this director. I hope he sticks with horror, just because it sort of bugs me when someone makes a really great horror movie and then they say, "I'm making a completely different genre next." Like, I want like a good horror director to stick around for a while, because there's no modern equivalent of John Carpenter right now that I can think of, and that's what I want. I want someone like that.
That's what Adam Wingard, he was talking about making a World War I movie, a huge, and I was like, maybe you should.
It's like,
stick with
horror. Yeah, make another horror movie, please. I mean, I just want a director who makes that his forte, if you will.
Yeah, we need more good horror films from good horror directors, but people that actually love the genre,
right,
that are qualified to be directing movies, and not a lot of these After Dark, really dirt cheap budget films where the story itself can't walk on two legs, let alone.
Well, and Honeymoon was another
yes,
one.
Yes, yeah.
Indie, yeah.
Which did a lot with a very little, very small budget.
Why do you think these first-time directors start with horror? Like, that seems like it would be such a difficult...
Because it's cheap. And
yeah, horror is is a really cheap... I mean, look
I
at,
guess because
like,
the acting doesn't have to be as good.
Exactly. Right. And look at, like, Sam Raimi, he made Evil Dead. That's, like, his first movie. Everyone just... And George Romero, he made Night of the Living Dead. It's because the horror has a very universal appeal.
It also has a built-in niche audience.
Yeah, exactly.
People go to horror conventions and all sorts of things like that.
Yeah, it's easier to classify. If you're just like, my first movie is a drama.
Thank you.
It's like, all right, what about? But you say horror, that instantly has a built-in audience.
Well, chess movies, they have like a nice
niche. Yeah, it's all those really popular chess films. Like
Searching
Rook.
For Bobby Fischer.
All right,
Little Man Tate. Was that about chess?
No, but they came out the same year. I confuse them as well.
It's like the same movie.
What's the final verdict? I loved It Follows as a movie, but I don't think that it's like it didn't feel like a horror movie to me. It just felt like a creepy drama almost.
Okay. I loved It Follows, and I think it's a very scary movie. I disagree. Entirely.
Maybe it was the hype.
That.
Maybe it's because I watched it at 10 a.m. I don't know.
I just want to say something about that. I feel like the hype is good, but I also hate it. I hate, because like the Babadook had the same thing with me. That movie was so hyped up, and when I watched it, I liked it, but I was sort of like, really? Is this it after all that hype? I feel like hype sometimes hurts things.
Have you seen the Dada Book yet?
No, because that's not a real thing. But yeah, my final verdict on It Follows is, I don't think it's as great as everyone is saying. At the same time, though, it's an excellent movie. So, go if you like horror, absolutely you should see this.
It's a great movie.
Yeah, it's creepy. It's very well directed. It's very well acted. I loved pretty much the entire cast of this film. Not just Maika Monroe, but just the whole supporting cast had this very nice...
Natural flow.
Natural, like...
chemistry.
Her and I forget the actor's name, but not the neighbor, but the one boy who's had, like, a crush on her
every year.
They had a really nice sort of natural... And it's great because they're supposed to be friends for years, and it felt like that.
You get that.
Yeah.
It's not that typical, what do they call it? The friend zone?
Yes. Yeah.
There's none of that.
It felt real.
Yes, it did. It felt like a real...
Like, these felt like real young people. It wasn't just like, yo, dude, let's go to the arcade.
Like, and they didn't try, like, over-explaining characters. They're just, like, there, and they had, like, a very natural vibe. It wasn't like, oh, that's Shelly from across the street.
And the setting is great, too, because it takes place in the suburbs.
Right.
And if you grew up in the suburbs, like a lot of people do...
Yes.
You just... there's a sense of, oh, there's that from, that's like in my neighborhood, and oh, there's that abandoned shitty house, yeah, just like in my
The house that It Follows takes place in is identical to the house I grew up in, which was creeping me out the whole movie.
And you still didn't find it scary?
It connected nostalgically, but not creep, not scary.
Were you all hopped up on whippets or goofballs?
You took a bunch of pep pills before I
Dave, did you actually watch this movie?
But it is cool how it takes place like in living rooms with a parent in the background. It's like environments that you're very familiar with.
Yeah, that was like my entire youth, basically. Yeah.
You're just waiting for the parent to leave so you can be yourself.
So you can hang out with the sex ghost.
So yeah, hopefully we haven't spoiled it too badly. But you should definitely check out It Follows.
Yeah.
It's it might be playing in your city.
And we're not.
And what follows after this break?
We're going to get to our new director and our director's series.
It. Okay.
What? Well.
That went nowhere.
I hope we can edit that out.
Ah, come forth and let me tell you the tale of CutPrintFilm.com, a film review, editorial, and news website.
Have they got any loot there?
They do. Oh, I can't find it. Does anyone know where the loot is?
I have one right here.
Cutprint Film has a merry band of men.
Do they drop the beat?
Yes, they do! It includes More Like Radio, Joystick Jerks, and Anti-Fanboy.
Hello, everybody. We're back.
I hate this song.
It's the top of the ninth, and
this is what's this song called?
This is called "Baby Elephant Walk."
Oh, how appropriate!
Yes,
we're discussing David Lynch's "The Elephant Man."
I hope it gets us sued.
Yeah, this is where we lose our fortune.
We get sued by Major League Baseball. So the director series is a thing we do on Cutprint Film where we pick a director, we pick three films from that director, and then we talk about those films over a period of shows. And, of course, if you're interested in reviews and editorials, why not go to cutprintfilm.com? It's our website. And we update it pretty much every single hour, like lunatics.
Yeah, there's something new up there about every hour.
We have no lives. Please go to the website. We do it for you.
We have news. We have reviews. We have interviews. We have editorials. We have this very podcast.
That's right.
We've got it all.
And this is a very special director because this is our first requested director.
Yes.
What was that gentleman's name again?
His name was Will.
Will.
David Lynch. Oh.
No. Yes, David Lynch requested this himself. Will from California, he requested this, and we encourage you, the listener, not Will, because his chance is over, but everyone else other than Will.
Will has to wait 15 years until he can request a movie.
He's
again,
on the wait
or director
list.
Again.
Yeah, we encourage you, if you have a director you want us to cover on the director series, email us, tweet us, whatever floats your boat.
Yeah, you can email us info@cutprintfilm.com.
That's right.
And say, hey, guys, why don't you do a director series on the films of, say, I don't know, Mel Brooks, and we'll say, we already did that, and it didn't go very well.
Yeah, we got one good film out of it. But I think we have some production for the director series, is that
we
true?
We do. Let me just press.
Hello, my baby. Hello, my director series.
No, that's not it at all.
Dave, that's not very good.
You put this bear trap over your head.
Ouch.
It's the Cutprint Film Director Series. Action.
Directors!
Pass the popcorn. Put a piece in my mouth.
Very okay. Concise and to the point.
I'm gaining a little weight from all this popcorn week after week.
Yeah. It's one piece a week. Come on.
It adds up, Dave. It adds up. All right. So, yeah, this next few shows, our director is David Lynch.
It should be the next three shows because there's nothing good coming out.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah,
theoretically, we like to do these three episodes in a row. Sometimes that doesn't happen.
Yeah, sometimes a quote-unquote good movie comes out and we talk about that, but that won't be happening for a while
because
we're still in March. I have a little bio for David Lynch, and hopefully I won't sound like a goon as I talk about it.
All right. A biopsy?
Yes.
I hope it's not negative.
Yeah.
I hope he's sick with something.
I took out my lancet, and I cut off one of his moles, and now I'm going to read you from the mole.
What?
I wrote this all down on David Lynch's mole. Just go with it.
It's like rice writing on the boardwalk. Except it's not on a cancerous mold.
Yes, from a famous director. Born in precisely the kind of small-town American setting so familiar from his films, David Lynch spent his childhood being shuttled from one state to another as his research scientist father kept getting relocated. The experience of having a child at the age of 21, plus attending art school in a particularly violent and rundown area of Philadelphia,
indeed,
inspired Lynch to direct Eraserhead, a film that he began filming in the early 1970s in which he would work on obsessively for 5 years. The strange, uncommercial film secured Lynch a cult following and led him to make his first mainstream film in an unlikely alliance with Mel Brooks, The Elephant Man, in 1980, which is today's film. The Elephant Man's enormous critical and commercial success helped land Lynch the film Dune in 1984, but the film was a hugely expensive commercial disaster. Lynch redeemed himself with the now classic Blue Velvet in 1986, his most personal,
so soft.
His most personal and original work since his debut. He subsequently won the top prize at the Cannes Film Festival with the dark, violent road movie Wild at Heart, and achieved a huge cult following with his surreal TV series Twin Peaks. Mm-hmm. Some of his other credits include films like Lost Highway, Mulholland Drive, and Inland Empire.
Okay. So David Lynch, he's a bit of an odd duck.
Yes, he's mostly known for weird movies.
I've, for the most part, steered clear of David Lynch when it comes to my movie viewing habits.
I have a low tolerance for weird.
I do, too.
Not me. I love it.
See, I love horror, and I love drama, and I love quirky comedies,
right.
But I don't like weirdness in my drama. I don't like that. And that's what Lynch is. Lynch is a drama director with very, very strange sensibilities, and I honestly, for the most part, have no time for bizarre dramas. I don't like them.
But I would argue that a lot of his films do fit into the horror genre. I would say both Lost Highway and Mulholland Drive could be classified as horror films, especially Lost Highway.
Yeah.
But we'll talk about that later.
Yeah, we'll get to that film.
Yeah. Well, not Lost Highway, but Mulholland Drive.
When we came into The Elephant Man, the only David Lynch stuff I had seen was The Lost Highway,
right,
back in the 90s. And I only saw that because Trent Reznor produced the soundtrack, and that was my link to the film.
Jeff is a Reznhead.
Yes, I'm a Rezhead.
That's the only reason you saw Gone Girl, too, right?
No. It's one of the reasons I saw Gone Girl.
That's the only reason he has all those How to Destroy Angels albums on vinyl.
Exactly. And I said, this was a terrible mistake to purchase all these. This music's nearly unlistenable. And I had also seen part of Twin Peaks, which I can honestly say I'm not a big fan of because, again, it's a drama with some very strange aspects tied into it. So being one of the few people that I've ever talked to that isn't a fan of Twin Peaks, going into The Elephant Man, I was a little nervous. But I got to say, this movie surprised me. And unsurprisingly, this is one of David Lynch's least Lynchian films.
Yes, this is his most mainstream film. Although there are some Lynchian, the very touches, the opening sequence, which involves the Elephant Man's mother pretty much being raped by an elephant. Yeah. I mean, they say she was trampled, but the way it's filmed it's clear she's having some elephant sex going on here.
I hope so.
Is very David Lynchian. Also, there's a running theme of like industrialization. There's always some sort of like churning machinery going on, and
a lot of Eraserhead.
Yeah, that's in Eraserhead. Almost the entire film, there's always like humming machinery in that film. So a lot of that is in this film.
The opening scene with the elephant bugged me because it's not scientifically accurate at all. That couldn't happen.
Yeah,
they didn't.
Elephants
go out to dinner.
Could never throw a woman down.
There was no ring. He didn't propose. They were out of wedlock.
Yeah,
I almost turned it off.
There's nothing in the Bible about elephants having sex with women, so it's not real.
Okay, so I have a plot synopsis.
Ah, yes,
for The Elephant Man, and it goes a little something like this.
Hum it for us.
Well, if I hum it, it'll be
indecipherable.
Yes, nobody will know what I'm saying.
Well.
Okay. London hospital surgeon Frederick Treves finds John Merrick in a Victorian freak show where he is kept by the proprietor, Mr. Bites. His head is always hooded, and his owner views him as mentally, I don't want to say challenged. I think he thinks of him as mentally inept.
Yes.
Just a complete imbecile. Is paid by Treves to bring him to the hospital for examinations. He shows Merrick to his colleagues and highlights his monstrous skull, which makes him sleep with his head on his knees.
Yeah.
And if he were to lie down, he would asphyxiate and die. Upon Merrick's return to Mr. Bites, he is beaten so bad that Treves has to be called back and take him to a hospital to treat his wounds or he'll die. John Merrick is tended and quarantined by the... Is she a nun or is she the head nurse?
She's a nurse.
Okay.
Yeah.
The head nurse, Mrs. Mothershead.
What a good name.
Yeah. Since the rest of the staff cringe away from Merrick. Mr. Cargom is the hospital... I guess this says the governor. So he's like the manager,
yeah. Essentially.
Yeah.
He's against housing Merrick as the ward is no place for what he calls incurables.
Yes. Because they used to have back then, they had, hospitals for incurable people.
Yeah, which would just be like asylums.
Chris. Yeah. You're like me. I'm never getting better. Sorry.
Chris has a bad case of the sniffles. It's fatal.
Sorry, everyone.
To prove to Cargom that Merrick has skills, Treves makes him say a few phrases that they rehearsed beforehand. Cargom sees through the ruse, but as he walks off, he and Treves are stunned to hear John recite the 23rd Psalm, which Treves did not teach him.
It was such a nice scene.
It was. A lot of really nice scenes, yeah. Sweet scenes in this. Cargom now permits John to stay, and the patient starts drawing, reading, and making a model of the cathedral across the street. Well, actually, in the distance that he sees from his window.
Yeah.
When Merrick has tea with Anne Treves, Mr. Treves' wife's, he is so overwhelmed that he shows them his mother's picture, and he hopes she would love... He hopes that she would love to see him with his what he calls lovely friends.
Mm.
He's obsessed with friendship.
Yeah. Well, he's a lonely man.
Yes, he is.
An elephant man, if you will.
Yes, he is. He has tusks and all. Later on, he starts to have guests in his rooms, including the actress Madge Kendall, and becomes an object of curiosity and charity to high society people.
Once again.
Yes. No. No.
What happened?
I think the riffraff was going to see him before. Mrs. Mothershead says that he is still treated as a freak, though in a more upper-class style.
Yeah.
Yeah, see? She agrees with me.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Well, you and her are tight, so.
This rebuke and his role in the matter trouble Mr. Treves, who now questions his morals in bringing Merrick and showing him to all these people. And while John is treated well by day, the night porter... by the name of Jim, makes money by bringing clients from nearby pubs to gawk and laugh at John Merrick.
What a dick.
Yeah, not a good guy.
No. Sorry, Jim. You're a jerk.
This guy works in the hospital. What is he, the fire stoker
or something?
He's
dressed like a security guard. I don't know. Yeah. You also, he has, like, tap shoes the first time we see him. He, like, walks down the hall with his tap shoes.
Through her daughter-in-law, Alexandra... the hospital's royal patron, Queen Victoria, sends word that Merrick will have permanent hospital care with all funds arranged. But his problems resurface when Bites uses Jim, the night porter, to reach John and take him to... It says continental Europe, but that was France, right?
Yeah, they're speaking French. Yeah. So.
To take him to France, where he is once again put on show in a carnival and brutalized.
Might have been Belgium. You never know.
You know what?
Well, I didn't see any pomfrites, so...
consumed with guilt over Merrick's plight, Mr. Treves fires the porter with Mrs. Mothersball's help.
Mrs. Motherboy.
That name is horrible. His fellow attractions and freaks help Merrick flee, and through a Liverpool street station, he is taunted by several boys and accidentally knocks down a girl, where he is chased, unmasked, and cornered by an angry mob, at which point he cries the famous phrase... I am not an elephant.
I love peanuts. What? Is that not what he says?
No, that's incorrect.
Come polish my tusks.
I'm sorry.
I never forget.
I am not an animal. I am a human being. Before I love peanuts.
Well, he's an elephant man.
When policemen return him to the hospital, he goes back to his room and recovers. But it is revealed that he is dying from chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. Mrs. Kendall, the actress, bids him to go to the theater where he, Mr. Treves, Mrs. Mothershead, and a nurse will see an enrapturing show.
Yes.
A white-tied John Merrick stands up in the royal box to reap a hearty applause, having had the performance dedicated to him from Mrs. Kendall. Back in the hospital, Merrick thanks Treves for all he has done and completes his church model. And he looks over at the wall and sees a painting of a sleeping child.
Which is just kind of mean to keep that in his room.
It is. It's not very nice.
You'll never sleep like this, John Merrick.
And so he takes all the pillows off his bed that he uses to sleep upright, lies down, and dies.
He must have gone to like Pier 1 Imports to get all those
pillows. Yes, that's a lot of pillows.
So it was like 40 pillows.
Consoled, he dies in bed, consoled by a vision of his mother, who quotes Alfred Lord Tennyson's "Nothing Will Die," and credits roll.
Yeah.
And that's the Elephant Man.
Yes. So.
Don't tell me that you love me.
What?
Tusk.
Oh.
Oh, good. We're quoting Fleetwood Mac.
Let's go there. All right. So what did everyone think of The Elephant Man?
I love this movie.
It's great. It's a great movie. It's like, it's so gorgeous. Visually yeah. beautiful.
It's so well yeah. made, and just the cinematography is wonderful.
It's fantastic. Yeah. This is David Lynch's second feature film.
Yeah.
And it was nominated for I think 8 Academy Awards.
Yes.
Go ahead. No, I was going to cut you off completely.
Oh, okay.
like a rude jerk.
It also got the Academy to start the category of best hair and makeup.
Right.
That's true.
Because of the makeup in this film, which is incredible.
Yes.
And it wasn't nominated for anything like that because that category didn't exist.
I was going to say that I love that Mel Brooks is the one who funded this.
I do too.
This is the second movie because he also did The Fly with David Cronenberg. And it's just like he's got
good taste for other people's movies.
Yeah.
His movies, not so much.
Mel Brooks originally wanted to direct this. But he was afraid people would think that it was a comedy.
Right.
And that's so smart, not like to be able to be that self-aware.
Yeah, he knows what he's doing.
He actually did everything he could to get his name completely scrubbed from.
Yeah, it's nowhere.
This
right?
film. Yeah, it was produced by Mel Brooks, but you don't see that.
It says Bell Brooks.
I believe it says the Brooks Company is the production company.
This movie recalls Young Frankenstein in ways too. Like it looks like it, and then there's that scene where he's giving the lecture,
right? And then the scene where the Elephant Man sings "Putting on the Ritz."
Yes,
but no, he is wearing the tuxedo like Frankenstein. Yeah, very similar.
The whole the scientist and the quote unquote monster is a big thing for this movie. So yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and there's
the scene where he's like, "Put the candle back."
Yes, the revolving bookcase in the Elephant Man's room.
Yeah, and the choice to make this in black and white is brilliant.
Oh, I love
it. It looks just as great as Young Frankenstein looked, and that black and white lends to the verisimilitude of the film in that it takes place in the 1880s.
Yeah,
so it already looks old. To make it black and white just makes it look classic.
I can't imagine this movie in it would be weird to see the Elephant Man in color.
Completely uninterested in anything like that.
This looks exactly like the Nick, the show,
just
like
in black and white.
Like the characters match up too. There's the governor, the surgeon, Treves is Clive Owen. Like the characters match up. It feels like they used this as a model to make that show, the Nick.
I'm sure they did, but I'm sure this, both the Nick and this are just borrowing from accurate period details too. Yeah. So,
and a lot of this film, there was a Joseph Merrick who was the actual Elephant Man in the 1800s.
Yeah, yeah. This is based on a true story, but it is highly fictionalized.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And even the parts that are based on the manuscripts of Dr. Treves, he paints himself in a very white light.
Yeah, he basically made up a lot of stuff. In his memoir, he made up a whole bunch of stuff about the Elephant Man's mother, all the stuff that actually didn't happen. So
he also paints John Merrick, or Joseph Merrick as he was called in real life.
Yeah.
Even the real Joseph Merrick was called John Merrick.
Right.
He went back and forth with it. But he painted Merrick as much more pathetic than he actually was, because Merrick you know, he got into the freak show business on his own accord. Yeah, that, he just thought, like, well, what else am I going to do?
Yeah. Back then, you know, if you were someone so horribly deformed, like, what are you going to do? And that's another thing. In the movie, all, you know, his handler is this abusive asshole, but in real life, they were just like, they were friends. They were business partners, essentially. But, you know, that. It's more cinematic to have a film where...
And it works for me.
Yeah. This, plus his name is Bites.
Yes, Mr. Bites.
Yeah.
His first name's Reality.
Yeah. Now we're talking.
His first name is Giga, I believe.
Yeah, and that makes sense because, like, the sensitivities back then weren't the same as they are now. So you could see him thinking of him as an imbecile, even though...
Even though he knew him personally and had apparently befriended him.
Yeah. Kind of like we all think Dave is the imbecile, but we do a show with him every week.
Dave, is your head soft? Or
Dave, put this hood on.
I love the first half of this movie. The second half gets a little schmaltzy.
Especially for David Lynch, this is a very sweetie sort of film where, and again, I like sweet stuff. And like, if the movie were all bleak and misery, I probably would hate it because I wouldn't want to watch it. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there are so many scenes where it's like...
He's crying.
Yeah, it's like, look how nice people are being.
Every time somebody's nice, the Elephant Man cries.
And I mean, you know, I understand that, but at the same time, it's like, oh.
I mean, there's a scene where he gives them like a box with like a comb and stuff in it. He's like,
oh my God.
A comb?
What did I? A toothbrush. And I mean, I get it because, you know, this is a character who's never had anyone be nice to him.
And he's also never had a home, like an actual home. And this is saying, this is your home. Here's your dressing kit.
Right.
This is for you to put in your home. And
it's also sort of like an uneventful film. Like, they had to make up stuff because in real life, he went to the hospital and he died. There was none of this. His handler came back and kidnapped him to France. Yeah. None of that happened. So it's really just like the story is doctor finds deformed guy dies. That's this movie. And it's sort of like after a while, it sort of was like, I wish something... Like, basically, the Elephant Man had a very uninteresting life. You'd think he would have an interesting life because of the way he looked, but he really didn't. And
go ahead.
It's inspired by a play, and you can feel that throughout the film that it's...
Well, it's not even, though, because there's a credit at the end of the film that says, this film has nothing to do with the play.
Yeah, but I mean, the play existed before this.
Yeah.
So, a lot of these scenes feel very play-like.
Oh, yeah. They're all single location. Yeah. Everything's more dialogue-driven than it is event-driven.
The play, I just want to briefly touch on very briefly. The play does this really interesting thing where the actor playing the Elephant Man doesn't wear makeup.
Yeah, which expressly says that he shouldn't wear makeup.
Yeah, it's all acting through physicality, which is kind of... It wouldn't work in a movie, but I would love to see that on stage.
We got to talk about the performance by John Hurt, who played the Elephant Man, because it's unbelievable.
It's fantastic.
And he's hidden entire. His entire head is hidden behind this grotesque makeup.
And it can't be easy to act with, because he has to... It's a lot of emoting. It's not just, you know, he's not just... It's not like Jason Voorhees behind a mask.
So it's basically all his voice doing the work. It's the inflections. It's the highs and the lows that he hits. And... My God, this is one of the most affecting voice acting performances I've ever seen.
It's very, wet.
And John Hurt has a very distinct voice, and it doesn't sound anything like him.
This sounds like a pathetic man who has nothing. And it's, I don't know, there's just a real sweetness to the character.
There is.
And it's all his voice, because there's no facial... movements or anything like that. It's just all voice acting, and it's incredible. And you feel so horribly for John Merrick anytime anybody treats him poorly that it breaks your heart.
Yeah, the scene where they're like pouring alcohol down his throat.
It's horrifying.
It's hard to watch. And even though I was just complaining it gets a little too sweet, that first time where Anthony Hopkins takes John Merrick to meet his wife, and John Merrick just starts crying. Like, that, like, got me choked up a little. I felt, like, bad. I was like, oh, I feel bad for the Elephant Man.
This movie had me choked up a few times.
Wow.
Choked up.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. For those who have just never heard the show before, Jeff is a robot, so this is kind of shocking to hear this.
I had my tear ducts cauterized.
It's a scientific success. We've made a machine feel emotion.
It's not tears, but oil that leaks from Jeff's eyes.
Oil. This movie really, really worked for me in the emotion department.
Yeah.
It tugged all the right heartstrings for me.
Nice.
And yes, it is very, very saccharine, yes. Very sweet at times, especially when the Elephant Man cries every time somebody does something nice for him.
Elephant Man, you dropped something.
Oh, thank you. I didn't.
But yeah, and that's mostly thanks to John Hurt's performance because he's absolutely incredible.
But let's talk about Anthony Hopkins.
Absolutely, where I'm going with that, Anthony Hopkins, who now only takes roles where he sits on the floor.
he wears sweatpants.
Yes, he wears his sweatpants and he sits in a haystack, and that's his entire his recent body of work.
He Skypes in for his performances.
He's actually acting in this film.
Yeah,
and
Anthony Hopkins is obviously a good actor, but he's reached a point in his career where he's always hamming it up. Basically, when he won the Oscar for Silence of the Lambs, which is a great performance, but it's also a little hammy. He was like, "I'll just do this from now on." Yeah. So every role after that has been this sort of like borderline Hannibal Lecter hamminess, and he's so
not that.
He's so reserved in this movie. It's almost shocking.
Yeah, as good as John Hurt is in this, I love Anthony Hopkins' performance. Yeah. It's like
it's a very quiet sort of performance. He's always like looking at things.
He's always like his eyes are like darting around, and he's always kind of like talking like really overly gentle, which comes off as a little weird and creepy. Did you guys get that?
See, I didn't get that. Dave was saying that in our frequent texts to each other. Dave was saying that he thought Anthony Hopkins.
LOL.
Yeah. BRB, watching Elephant Man. Dave was saying that he thought Anthony Hopkins was weird in this, which I didn't really get. I don't know.
There's like a strangeness to his performance. It's really subtle,
he's disconnected. That's what I get.
Yeah.
He seems, you know, just unattached.
He seems like very medical is how it felt
to me. Yeah,
like,
I would agree with that.
Like he's trying to be nice, but it's like kind of like you, Jeff, trying to be nice. It doesn't come naturally to
us. Faking it.
And the first time you see him actually feel emotion is when he's sitting in that chair and he's like, "I feel like I'm the same as Mr. Bites."
Right.
You know, like that's the first time where you're like, "Oh, this isn't a."
And there's that scene where he blows up at that. What's the guy's name? Jim.
Jim. Yeah.
And I love that because it's the first, like, he rages out and he doesn't do that. That's, like, the only time he raises his voice in the film. And I kind of like that.
Yeah, I mean,
because it was like all his proper English walls came tumbling down.
And there's a lot of propriety, you know, mixed in with a screenplay about how, you know, all the upperclassmen are the ones that are nice to Mr. Merrick.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, could it just be, like, isn't that, like the era? Just that's how gentlemen acted, sort of, that sort of stiff.
And being that this is based heavily on Mr. Treves' manuscripts, that, you know, bias toward the upper class being the ones that are good and the lower, the riffraff being horrible monsters.
That's true. I almost didn't pick up on that. Yeah. Like,
It's definitely a biased outlook.
And, everyone who isn't a doctor and is a scumbag in this movie.
And the what's his name, Mr. Kargom?
Kargom, yeah.
He's might be the smartest person in the film. Yeah. Nothing gets by this guy.
Yeah.
Which I did like that. I like that this guy was so sharp.
Yeah.
That he knew as soon as Treves tried to sneak Merrick in, he knew well.
And even that scene is really good where he's like trying to sneak him the food and he's like, "What are you doing with this porridge?" And then he like gives it to the nurse. He's like, "Take this to Mr. Merrick or whoever."
"Take this to the Elephant Man, who I know is upstairs."
What was I going to say? That I like that. Okay, so you were saying the riffraff versus the high class.
Yeah.
And that's at its highest point when the fucking princess shows up to deliver
absolutely. The princess has to tell the higher class just under her to behave like nobility.
Yeah.
Because
you're doing a great job. We're not going to give you any money.
I'm a noble woman and this is what we have to do.
Yeah. There's like a board of directors and there's one doctor. He's like, "We want to kick the elephant." He talks exactly like that. "We want to kick the Elephant Man out.
We'd prefer if the Elephant Man were boiled alive."
And then the princess shows up and says, "Good news. The Elephant Man is the new king of England." And she puts the crown on his giant head.
It's fucking, who is that? Babar or whatever?
Yes, the Elephant Man Babar.
And that's how Babar was discovered.
It is interesting though, because were you waiting in that scene for it to be like, and the queen is going to pay for him to stay at the hospital,
something like that. But
they're like, no, you guys just take care of it. We just like what you're doing.
Yeah. You know, I kind of like that, because that's absolutely what the queen
yeah, that
would
is
do.
True.
Yeah.
Like, yes, you will do this. You'll also pay for it.
Yeah. Get your own shillings, she said.
Make sure the elephant man files his taxes.
So, yeah, I mean, a lot of this film, a lot of what works for me in this film are the performances, because
right.
that's the bulk of what this film is,
yes.
is the performances. There's not many set pieces, and the set pieces that are there are great.
Like,
you get this great Industrial Revolution setting.
And that were like that's built into the soundtrack, because the mm-hmm. sounds, the industrial
like
sounds
churning.
Are always this. They're like the music almost.
Yeah, I believe Frontline Assembly did the soundtrack, the great industrial band from the late 80s.
The sound design in this film is just great, because it's like not only is that churning like machinery sound, but he ties it in with like John Merrick's like heartbeat at the end, and I really like that. The one set piece I really liked and I wish there was more of is that those French freaks who helped John Merrick.
Yeah.
I want a whole movie about them where like it's the midgets and like the tall guy and the I just
what the is it midget or do we say little person?
I don't know.
I don't want to be rude.
Whatever I said, pretend it was right.
It's the right thing to say.
Yeah. I'll say little person just so we can have it both ways.
I meant no offense. Pretend whatever I said was right.
Chris meant to say, it's the world's smallest man. Step right up.
I love the way it was shot, where like the elephant man's in a cage. It was almost like early Tim Burton-y.
That setting is awesome.
Yeah, it's like Pee-wee's Playhouse, sort of.
I believe the
little person in this is R2-D2.
Oh, yes.
No, I'm serious.
Oh, the actor? Oh,
yeah.
You're right.
Yeah, I think
Kenny Baker.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right. And he was in, what the hell is that movie called? Time Bandits. He was in that, too, the Terry Gilliam film.
Yes, 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 yes.
There was one thing that bugged me about this film, and I don't know if you guys picked up on it or if it's just me being strange, but it kept fading at weird times. It felt like the scene hadn't ended yet, and it would fade out.
There's some strange cuts.
Yeah. Like, almost like...
That
something
really
got screwed up right after, so they're trying to fade it before.
I was trying to forgive Lynch, like maybe that was like an artistic direction or something like that. No, I think something didn't work.
Yeah, he might have dropped the film in his Pepsi or something.
I don't think that's even possible.
That's interesting. Dave, was your mother trampled by an idiot?
The idiot man.
Oh, Lord. I'm sorry, that was very mean.
That was mean, but funny. I don't know. I mean, it's weird, but it didn't take me out of the film.
Yeah.
I don't know.
No, it didn't take me out of it, but I noticed it. And I shouldn't notice a cut.
Yeah, exactly.
Unless I'm supposed to, and I don't think I was supposed to notice these really sharp, ugly-looking cuts.
Yeah.
But what I did notice that I know I'm supposed to notice is the dream sequences that John Merrick has, which are really, really... big Lynch calling cards.
Yeah, they're very surreal. That was sort of like, I think he just included them because he wanted an excuse to have his weird stuff in it, because there's not a lot of that in this film. So.
And it's like you said, the introduction, we get that, and, some of the industrial elements to the film, and this one, is there one or two dream sequences?
I think there's two.
Where you just get these strange flashes. It looks almost similar to what The Ring did. The Ring is very heavily influenced by David Lynch as far as the visuals. And I like that a lot. And like I said, I'm not big on Lynch in general, but I did like that. So maybe I will like the upcoming films.
Well, the one dream implied that the guy Jim is doing that to him the whole movie, and he just keeps like suppressing it, right?
Because
he shows him the mirror and he screams, but before he does it, he's like, get a load of this. Like he had done it many times before, and he does it in the dream. So it seems like that is almost not a dream. This is really happening.
Yes, Mia Farrow appears with her sensible new mom haircut.
Yes.
It is slightly Polanski-ian, though, in a way.
I guess you could say that, yeah.
Yeah,
I can see that. I can definitely see that. But yeah, I mean, this is... a great movie. I think this is a great movie. It's one of the best movies I've seen in a while.
It's very well made. It's just I guess I'm the one person on the show who's well versed in David Lynch.
Yes.
So it's weird for me to see such a, I'm not going to say simple movie, but for David Lynch, this is a simple movie.
Straight narrative.
Yeah, so it's kind of jarring in a way to see that. And I think that's another reason why the sweetness sort of took me aback, because his other films are not sweet at all. They're very dark, and even though they have a sense of humor, they're very twisted, and that's not happening here. So I'm not used to that. At the same time, it's a gorgeous film.
It is.
It's incredibly well directed.
Yeah, there is something that makes it not a masterpiece, though. Like, it could have been.
It's so close, too.
Yeah.
I think it's so simple.
Yeah, that's what it is.
There's a lot to it.
Yeah.
And there isn't a sense of humor about itself
at
all.
It's
very, it's syrupy. It is.
And, like, I feel like as great as John Hurt's performance is in this film, I feel like we don't really ever learn that much about the Elephant Man.
No, you just feel for him.
Yeah, like, he's not so much a character as he is. Like an object.
Yeah.
He's sort of like what he is to everyone else in the film.
Yeah. That's true.
And like, I feel like if the film had just gone into his sort of psyche just a little bit more, it would have put it over that top and have been like more of a masterpiece.
This doesn't feel like a movie made in 1980, though.
No.
It feels like 1969-ish.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. This feels like a movie made like, I don't know, 25 years earlier.
Yeah.
Which says something about the direction, because this, like I said, it feels classic in both look and feel. So.
Like, Young Frankenstein was, what, 74, I'm going to say?
74.
And that looks more modern than this, almost.
Yeah, it's crisper.
Yeah.
Although, I don't know that I watched I don't know if there is a Blu-ray version of this or a restored version, but I know I watched a restored version of Young Frankenstein. So that might have had a...
But, like, Young Frankenstein is recalling movies that are 25 years older than it. So it's, like, strange that this is... This seems like an older movie, which is intentional because of the setting.
I think it's like the way the shots are just set up and stuff. Yeah. It's a very classic sort of framing. It's not.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But those strange cuts add to it, too.
Yeah.
Like, they feel like 40s.
Yeah, that's true, because older movies do have that a lot, where a scene just ends where it just fades out. Like, the original Todd Browning's Dracula, almost every scene just ends with just like... Someone's talking, and then it just fades with their mouths open.
There's some scenes like that in It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah.
And like the original
I got the
Christmas
It's a Wonderful Life feel from this a lot.
Yeah.
A lot.
Especially when it started snowing and the Elephant Man ran through England. Merry Christmas, England!
I just meant the schmaltziness of it, you know?
Yeah. And maybe that's intentional. Maybe Lynch is like, I want to call these movies that I loved as a kid.
It very well could be. I mean, I beat him up about the hard cuts, but that might have been intentional.
Yeah,
maybe it was. Maybe I'm an asshole. Probably.
Well.
I'm not David Lynch, master director.
We'll determine that another time.
Considered the number one greatest director of all time on a lot of lists is David Lynch.
He, judging from this film alone, he's fantastic.
I'm really excited about this director series, because I'm curious to see how both of you react to the other two films in the series, because they're nothing like this movie. So I'm
hopefully
very...
I get a rash.
As long as there's no sex in them, I'll be fine.
Yeah.
Well, you're out of luck, because our next film is Blue Velvet.
Oh boy.
So yeah, those of you at home who like to play along with the director series and don't just listen blindly to these shows, make sure you watch Blue Velvet for the next episode.
Yeah. Our final. Take on the Elephant Man is good.
It's a good movie.
I
would say it's great.
It is great. Yeah. It's a great movie. Yeah.
I was not excited about watching this. When you picked it, I was like, that's the one I wouldn't have picked.
Well, that's typically how these director series go, is I pick the worst one.
It's better than I remember, because I had seen this, but when this got picked, I was a little disappointed, because I thought, oh, really? The Elephant Man out of all his films? But watching it, I was impressed just how well-made it is.
Yeah.
And I love those little Lynch touches. I love that opening scene with the elephant, you know, throwing his mom down and she shakes her head. And just the way that's filmed, that's such a David Lynch thing. And I love seeing that, you know, so I like it a lot.
Yeah.
I was just thanking God there was no David Lynch movie involving virtual reality.
Jeff would have picked that instantly.
Which is incredible, because I hate those types of movies, and yet I continually pick them.
Gigabytes Drive.
All right. Well, that's our Elephant Man talk. I guess we should recommend some movies.
I guess.
All right. Let's do this then.
Film, weekly movie, recommendation. That's a classic.
Yeah, that's an oldie but a goodie.
I haven't heard that in a long time.
I figured I'd pick that one because it's so classic sounding. It would fit right in with the Elephant Man.
Nice
one.
Sounded like John Merrick doing that.
He was singing that through his hood.
All right, so who wants to go first?
I will.
Good.
So I'm going to sort of break the mold here, and I'm going to pick – it's a TV show, but it's sort of a documentary, and it's only 6 episodes. So
is it a cinematic?
It's very cinematic.
TV show?
Yeah.
It's right. Very cinematic. So let's count it.
I'm supposed to not know what he's saying.
That's all right. Let's count it as a movie. So my pick, the last episode airs – well, tonight when we're recording the show, but the show will be online tomorrow, so it'll already have aired. It's The Jinx, The Life and Deaths of Robert Durst.
Is this the Domino's Pizza mascot?
No, that's the Noid. Oh. He ruins pizzas. So yeah, The Jinx, obviously it's based on a true story. They actually made a movie about this whole thing. It was called
All Good Things. I just watched it today.
With Ryan Gosling. It's not that good.
It was all right.
It's all right, but for as crazy as the real story is, the film should have been much better.
Yeah.
So Robert Durst, he's a millionaire heir to a real estate fortune, and he's
a cool guy.
He's creepy. He blinks a lot, and so basically, his wife vanished, and everyone assumes, and they're probably right, that he killed her, but nothing ever came of that. But then later, a woman he was friends with was also killed. And again, everyone assumed he did it, but nothing ever came of that. And then much later, he basically ran away, lived on the lam as a woman in this apartment. And his neighbor in the apartment was murdered and dismembered. And he went on trial for that. And while he admitted to dismembering, he said the death was an accident. And the jury acquitted him, so he didn't go to jail. And so basically, has this sort of mythic craziness built around him. And after All Good Things came out, he contacted the person who wrote that film and said, oh, I want to tell you the real story. So this documentary is literally Robert Durst sitting down telling his side of the story, but he's so obviously lying everything he tells that it's amazing. It's an incredible – I've never seen a show or quote-unquote movie done like this, and it's so well done. It's so interesting. It's sort of the film equivalent to the podcast Serial. That's how it was billed as. But I actually find it more interesting than Serial, just because it's
visual.
I watched the first episode of it last night, and it's not only is it visual, which Serial can't do,
right,
it's also just better produced.
Yeah, it looks great.
I mean, it's got HBO production values, whereas Serial has NPR public radio production values.
But
I mean,
almost everything like visual that's is done. What's that word? It's like reenactments, but they've never been done this well.
It's very similar to Earl Morris's The Thin Blue Line, which is a similar sort of true crime movie, and he does reenactments, but they're not as polished and film looking as this.
Yeah, this is very cinematic. Yeah. Okay. Like they're built in,
and it's just every episode you think, oh, this can't get any crazier, and it gets crazier the shit they reveal. And
are the reenactments as good as the true TV show Who the F Did I Marry?
No one can. They're almost as good as Unsolved Mysteries.
Excellent. That's
where
all I ask.
Everyone has a mustache for some reason
and abs.
And it's weird because tonight the last episode airs, and then this morning, I guess it's a spoiler, Robert Durst was arrested. And I can't imagine how that happened. It's insane that happened the same day the last episode airs. I doubt the episode's going to include that.
It's probably Illuminati related.
Yeah, probably. Or Jay-Z and Beyonce are behind it.
You're going to get us all killed.
You said he's so obviously lying, but he is very convincing, and he's kind of mesmerizing to listen to.
It's weird. I feel sort of bad for him because even though you know he probably did it, he's also so pathetic seeming. Mm-hmm. And you can tell he's sort of like lonely. Like the last episode, the one that aired last week, it was all about his family. And it reveals that his family is just kind of creepy and weird, just like he is. And there's a scene where he goes to his brother's house and he just stands outside and he's just waiting. And the people making the film are like, I don't think he wants to leave until someone comes out and tells him to leave. And it's just he's just this lonely sort of guy. And you almost feel bad for him if he weren't a fucking murderer.
He has these creepy black eyes. Yeah. They are
like a doll's eyes. And they bite and they roll over white.
Well.
So, yeah, the HBO's The Jinx, The Life and Deaths of Robert Durst is my pick. Nice. That's a classic, too.
I guess I'll go to make this a delicious sandwich. My pick is a comedy from 1999, directed by Albert Brooks. It's called The Muse.
Wow, I remember this.
I'm a big Albert Brooks fan. I recently read, well, a couple years ago, I read his book 2030 and laughed my ass off the entire time. And I saw his movie Mother and a bunch of his other films. But The Muse is really, really funny. It's got kind of mixed reviews on Rotten Tomatoes. It stars Albert Brooks himself, Andy McDowell, and Sharon Stone.
Remember her?
Yep. She's actually terrific in this.
I do, yeah.
And so is Andy McDowell, an actress who I typically do not enjoy her work.
Yeah, she's. I liked her in Groundhog Day. That's it.
Mm-hmm. That's about where
that's where you draw the line.
Yeah. So this movie's about a writer played by Albert Brooks. He's a Hollywood writer. He writes movies, and he gets the information from his agent that he is being let go, released early from his contract because he doesn't have it anymore. He is washed up. And so he goes to his friend, played by Jeff Bridges, who is also a writer, who is doing great. He's made millions. He won the Academy Award. And Jeff Bridges tells him, well, I have a muse, and I'll introduce you. Maybe she'll help you, inspire you. And the muse is played by Sharon Stone. And Sharon Stone comes into Albert Brooks' life and changes everything. And it sounds silly, and it is silly. This is a very, very strange movie. But if you like Albert Brooks' weird comedic sensibilities.
Right.
I would compare him a little bit to Woody Allen. He has he's very meta.
He's almost like a more mainstream Woody Allen, I guess you could say.
He's definitely a meaner Woody Allen.
Yeah.
Because Albert Brooks, while it's not vicious, he does have a biting wit to him.
He's more into like surreal things than Woody Allen is.
Yeah. Really funny movie. And
I think I remember seeing this when I was like younger.
I remember this because there's a scene where Martin Scorsese shows up as himself, and I love Martin Scorsese.
And it's such a funny scene.
It's hilarious.
It's such a funny scene. There's a James Cameron cameo. It's just a really, really funny movie.
Is Catherine Bigelow in it?
There you go. No, Catherine, I was just waiting.
Catherine Bigelow is not in it at all. But yeah. My pick this week is 1999's The Muse. I think it's playing on Showtime or something like that.
Or at your local cinema, probably.
No. Nope. That's unlikely.
Nope. Nearly 15 years it came out. Like... Your turn, Dave.
Highly unlikely.
I love Albert Brooks in Drive. He's a great
Albert
character.
Brooks is great. Yeah. He's hang on a second. Go ahead, Dave.
I'm going to break the mold even more than Chris did and actually recommend a TV show.
Get out.
That is not at all cinematic.
Oh, well, man.
It's Roseanne.
It's
Have you seen Roseanne? So funny.
It's called American Idol.
We have Roseanne in studio.
You corrected the midgets thing, but that's okay.
Jeff was griping to me today that there's nothing good to watch on cable television. Mm-hmm.
And he said, what's the deal with these airline peanuts?
So my recommendation is a show on Robbie Rodriguez's new network that he started called El Rey.
Who the hell is Robbie Rodriguez?
The fucking guy who directed Robert Rodriguez.
Oh, yeah. Robert.
Robbie.
People call him Robbie.
Are people you?
It's like the way people call him Quentin Tarantino.
No, yeah, he's a fisherman, I believe.
Anyway, he started this, and I'm not a huge fan of Rodriguez at all. I don't think I like any of his movies.
No Robbie Rodriguez.
No.
From Dusk Till Dawn would probably be the closest thing. But anyway, he started a network, and the show on his network is him interviewing directors about their movies.
Okay. Oh, cool.
Interesting.
About their careers. He goes through every movie in their career and talks to them from a filmmaker point of view.
Oh,
like,
that does sound cool.
It is very cool. There's one with Guillermo del Toro, Francis Ford Coppola, John Carpenter, and there's a two-part one with Quentin Tarantino, which I just watched, and that is fucking awesome.
What's the network called?
It's called El Rey. The show's called The Director's Chair.
Okay. I almost thought it was going to be The Director's Series,
and I was going to bite my hat.
Yes.
So there's this stuff with Quentin Tarantino, and it's so awesome because they had a personal relationship through all this. They came up together as that second pack of directors.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
After the Scorsese.
Yeah, exactly. And, he tells a funny story about like Lucas, who had shown Star Wars to his director friends before anyone else had seen it.
And after that showing, a lot of them were like, oh geez, we got to tell George, like, this is not a good movie. But Spielberg was like, no, this is great. So Quentin brings that up, and he tells the story about when he screened Pulp Fiction for a room of directors, and the one person in the room who thought it was amazing was Catherine Bigelow.
Oh, wow.
Nice. Yeah.
And he said that she went around Hollywood, like, showing everyone she could the movie. But the other directors apparently got together, and they were like, we have to convince Quentin Tarantino to edit this thing, because it is a mess.
And what jerks.
Yeah. They're like, We'll sit down and talk to him after he gets back from Cannes. And then it just cuts to Clint Eastwood going, and the Palme d'Or goes to Pulp Fiction. Nice. It's like such a great, like, the show is cut with the clips of the movies and stuff, and it's just so well done.
That's cool,
I right? wasn't expecting this at all, because I was like, what is this? The director's chair? Because I'm just searching, like, movies on Xfinity.
Yeah.
Like a dork. But I can't believe I found this, and it's new. It's like ongoing right now.
That's cool.
It's season 2 right now, but they only do like 3 or 4 a season.
Nice. All right.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good really work. Cool.
What's it called again?
The Director's Chair.
And it's on the El Rey Network.
El Rey Network.
All right. I love it.
Well,
it's that time again, folks. Time to climb into the casket.
Yes.
I'll nail it shut for you. Because
do.
I'm not climbing in. I have much to live for.
Well, we're ending things on a dark note.
That's right. Good riddance to all of you.
I may have made Robbie Rodriguez up.
Yeah, I think you may have.
I don't believe it.
Anyway, as we said, go to our website, cutprintfilm.com. We've got news. We've got editorials. We've got reviews. We've got interviews. We've got it all and then some.
Follow us on Twitter.
That's right.
At cutprintfilm. Look at that. Now, Jinx, you have to buy me an axe to murder my neighbor with. I don't understand how that works.
Well, I'll get right on that.
Okay. A bow saw.
All right, good. you can also find us on Facebook. We are facebook.com/cutprintfilm.
That's right.
And we have some friends in the internet world.
That's right.
The Joystick Jerks, joystickjerks.com. They do a video game podcast. And much more on joystickjerks.com. They have news, they have reviews, they have all that stuff. Who else we got?
Beware the Ides of March.
What? No, antifanboy.com. They talk.
Thanks for that. That was not constructive at all.
They talk about video games and comic books and all that stuff.
Yeah.
You love it.
It's a pop culture blog.
Yeah. But as always, we encourage you to go onto iTunes, give this very show 5 stars.
Yes, 5 of them.
And write us a nice review. And hey, if we like your review enough, we'll read it on the air. No joke. We'll do it.
Here's one right now. Jeff, your chest hair is so full. I love this show.
Love, Chris.
Drink a bunch of green beer this week and then write a review.
Oh, that's right. It's St. Paddy's Day, everyone.
Listen. As an Irish American,
Jeff has a giant Irish head and he's not having any of this.
Let's see. It's comments like that that make me kill. Yeah. Don't get too drunk this St. Paddy's Day. Yeah. And if you're going to drink, don't drive. And if you do drive, listen to our podcast. The last thing you listen to.
As you go over the guardrail, laugh at our jokes.
And to your fiery demise.
So yeah, as we said, our film next week will be Blue Velvet. Make sure you watch it. Tune in next week. We'll be talking about it.
And we'll all be wearing blue velvet dungarees. that be something?
I have to get my blazer stitched.
No, you don't.
Stitched? What's wrong with
my blue blazer? It ripped. The Elephant Man borrow.
You know, David Lynch directs all his stuff in wearing a blue blazer.
Oh, he does?
Yeah, you didn't know that?
No.
That's something else.
Okay, now we learned something else.
You know who else was the blue blazer?
Owen Hart.
Owen Hart, that's right. And look what happened to him.
What's happening? What's... Who?